Welcome everyone to the April 5th, 2011 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We've got a full agenda today, although we don't, as unfortunately it's become the practice, we don't have some of the amendments and fiscals, so we'll be hearing things but not moving them today. We're going to start open a public hearing on Senate Bill 967. Richard.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 967 repeals existing statutes governing adjustment of public utility rates to account for taxes paid by electricity and natural gas utilities. There's no revenue impact, but I don't yet have a fiscal impact. And we have some pre-submitted testimony, a letter from Marcy Putnam in support of the bill.
Thank you. We have four panels that want to speak to this. The first one chaired or headed by Senator Atkinson and Commissioner Ackerman.
Madam. Mr. Chair, for the record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. And I sat in the middle chair, sat closer to the commissioner as a way of showing positive body language that, yes, in fact, we have worked all this out. This is more affectionately known as Senate Bill 408, the fix. Let me just give a little bit of history and some of the guideposts that we began on, and then certainly turn it over. As you recall, Senate Bill 408 was let me editorialize, at least from my own perspective, was a political reaction in the legislature to what was going on with Enron. And the thought that Enron was getting tax benefits for their balance sheet at the expense of the Oregon ratepayer. And through that and through the political pressure that was put upon the legislature to do something, Senate Bill 408 was passed. I can make that kind of editorial comment because at the time I voted no. And my consideration for the no vote was the potential of high expenses that ratepayers in Southern Oregon might pay. As it turns out, not that my ability to forecast was that good, but as it turns out, that is in fact what had happened. And what started as a consumer protection reaction to making sure that tax monies didn't leave Oregon to pad someone else's balance sheet, there was a windfall that started to come to companies, for better or for worse, based upon doing the exact opposite. Started to cost taxpayers more money, ratepayers more money. So we went in to fix this issue, and as the commissioner will say in far more detail, we had several groups to manage in the work group. Industrial customers, CUB, Avista, Northwest Natural, PGE, Pacific Core,
Labor.
How'd I do? Not bad for
industrial
no notes.
Customers.
Yeah, got industrial customers. And on the first day of the meeting, there was the thought that the 408 fix, this bill, would go too far. And I laid out, at least from my perspective, a guidepost. And the guidepost says, at least in my mind, that we were not going to reach back into a holding company's other companies to look for money by way of balancing the books. Or, more precisely, in the case of Pacific Core, we weren't going to look to Berkshire Hathaway and go after See's Candy Money, another company inside the holding company, to make good or make judgment or reporting for Oregon. And with those guideposts in the leadership of the fantastic legal mind to my left, we were able to bring this to you. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be delighted to answer questions, but I'd rather pass the buck to the brains of the outfit, the commissioner.
Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Mr. Chair, members of the Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development, I'm also very glad to be here and urge support of Senate Bill 967. I think the Senator actually summarized the issue that we were faced with quite well. This bill addresses problems that developed post-implementation of the 2005 bill, which was Senate Bill 408. It's a direct result of the work group that this committee instituted to work on that, and it was chaired very well by Senators Burdick and Atkinson, and included all the participants that Senator Atkinson has already mentioned. The stakeholders basically agreed that the original intention behind Senate Bill 408 was proper and good, but it had not worked well. So what they focused on in their month of discussions was developing a better approach to achieving the result of Senate Bill 408. There is written prepared testimony submitted by the joint parties that worked with us in that work group. I provided that, but I hadn't intended to read it verbatim into the record. I think it should go into the record, though. Importantly, it was prepared by the parties, the stakeholders in that work group, and they are satisfied that it represents and reflects their input and understanding of Senate Bill 967. So I just wanted to make that clear. I can give you a real short summary of what the bill does. But again, if there's any ambiguity between what I say and the language of the statute and the written testimony, that's where parties should refer to get the clarity. The first thing it does is it repeals Senate Bill 408 and replaces it, including the true-up mechanism, but replaces it with more precise directives to the OPUC to examine rates carefully in general rate proceedings in order to establish them correctly. For standalone utilities, it directs us to reflect tax liabilities and benefits associated with regulated utility operations. Importantly, and this goes to the Enron question that Senator Atkinson just mentioned, for utilities owned by a consolidated tax-paying group, it directs the Commission to consider other aspects of the utility and its consolidated tax-paying group, such as whether they're in a tax-paying structure or they have a history of underpayment or have a tax advantage structure in some way that it could be used to the disadvantage of Oregon consumers and the public interest here. So it gives us more authority to act in those cases to protect the public interest. It protects the sensitive tax information of unregulated subsidiaries or unregulated affiliates of the utility. It provides that we will establish a rule to establish what sort of tax information goes into the rate case filing and also how stakeholders can get a hold of that information and use it in their proceeding fully. And finally, it lets us use our existing authority to condition a merger or acquisition appropriately to protect the investor on these tax issues. So most of that information is in the written testimony, and I'm not going to go any further than that quick summary. I really did, though, want to sincerely thank Senator Atkinson and Senator Burdick. Their participation leadership was really quite useful, and I don't think we would have gotten here but for that leadership, number one. And I also wanted to thank stakeholders. We have great consensus here, and it may appear like we've all gotten to a kumbaya moment, but the truth is there were many concessions made by the parties. Some parties made some very difficult concessions, but I think we have a better result. The result is reflected in the language of Senate Bill 967, and I urge that you pass it. I'm also available for questions.
Ackerman, Atkinson, potato, potato, we worked the whole thing out.
Did I call you Senator Ackerman?
No, it's good.
I so apologize. I was just trying to elevate myself.
I'm just kidding.
It's okay, you made up for it anyway, Commissioner. It's rare that anybody says the legislators are useful for anything.
Mr. Chair, Senator Burke really should be down here, but I'll give her a pass and get at her later. But she did two up. She did great.
And I do want to thank you both and Senator Burdick as well. When the parties came and asked whether they could bring a bill, my initial reaction was no. In fact, hell no. But we did talk about it, and I said, if you can get together and have everybody agree to it, we will introduce a bill. And to assure there was some of that, I said, we will ask the commission to support this. And we'll ask Senator Atkinson and Senator Burdick to set in and keep everybody on the path. So congratulations to you folks for actually bringing something that people agreed to.
It's
the first time in 10 years that I've seen that. Senator Burdick.
Contrary to my good colleague, Senator Atkinson, I was the junior partner in this operation, so I wanted to express my appreciation to him. And when I walked into the group and I saw all these people around the table, I thought, oh boy, this is going to be quite a challenge. But I can't tell you strongly enough what a difference Commissioner Ackerman made, just the focused way that you kept everything on track and really helped to mediate the issues. It was kind of an inspiring process for me to go through. It's always nice to take something like this where you really don't have much expectation and actually get something out of it to solve a problem. So to both of you, and again, I was the junior partner in the operation, the right people are sitting at the podium here.
Senator Rock?
I hate to break the kumbaya, but it's not for Senator Potato. That's for Commissioner Ackerman. And I have someone that is concerned about some of the language in the bill, and I have two questions I need to ask you. If you don't know, it's a technical nature, and it deals with Section 1, Sub 2, Sub D. Well, again,
Section 1, Sub 2, Sub D,
and the question is the test period. And so utility rate making is based upon matching principles in a test period. In other words, a utility should be allowed to recover income tax expenses from ratepayers in the year those expenses are incurred. Correspondingly, a utility will share with ratepayers any income tax benefits it receives in the test period. This statute does not appear to place any time limits on the test period. It just talks generally about flowing through tax benefits with no time constraint. Is it the intent of the statute to match income tax expenses and benefits for the test period in which they occur? It's not the intention to allow mixing and matching of income tax expenses and benefits from different test periods, is it? So is that...
The answer is yes, generally. I mean, that's the way the rate-making process works. Is you choose a test year, you look at costs and benefits and in that test year, and you offset each other. You don't pick and choose from different years. So I would have to say generally yes. I would also say, though, that, you know, these rate-making proceedings get very complicated with evidence, and my job is to make a decision based on the evidence in the record. But I'm assuming that the utility will represent itself well, and we will have a fair review of these costs.
Okay. I like simple answers, so that works for me.
But I should have
kind of a simple sort of guy. Okay. And I'm sorry. This has the second question has to do with Section 1, Sub 3A.
I'm sorry. Can you give me that reference again?
Hold on here. Section 1, sub 3A. Hold on a second. Section 1, 3. It's like on page 2 of the bill.
Okay, gotcha.
A. Okay, this section provides that the PUC may consider the income tax payment history of utilities, affiliated groups, when evaluating the utility's income tax expenses in a rate-making proceeding. Please explain the number of years contemplated in this history. What is included in the history, original return filings, amendments, audits, etc. Also, this section appears to direct this historical evaluation to look for periods where less tax is paid by a group. What consideration will be given to those periods where more taxes are paid by the group? So it's a kind of a...
I understand the question, though,
Senator. I'm glad you do. I'm not sure I do. Okay.
The way I would answer that is that when we agreed on this language, all the stakeholders, what we were attempting to get at was the idea that you don't always know looking at a utility and its affiliated tax-paying group, whether you're going to have a problem or not. And parties, there might be indications out there that would indicate, Commission, you should apply some greater scrutiny to this utility or the taxes this utility pays or this merger, for example. And one indication would be if they have a long history of using the utility's taxes to the benefit of non-affiliated businesses, for example. That doesn't mean that the Commission would necessarily take any result in the rate case or take that and conclude anything particular in a rate case. It depends on the facts in the rate case. The parties wanted us to have something, though, that we should be looking at that would flag our interest. It does not compel a particular result. And so I couldn't put a timeline on that for you.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I could not.
Oh, that's still a pretty good answer. Thank you.
What?
Yeah, nope, I'm good.
Any other questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
The next panel, Marion Hayes, Michael Early, and Jim Anderson.
Bev Iyer, Jim Anderson with Avista Corporation. Avista is a natural gas utility serving southwest Oregon and eastern Oregon, and I will be brief. Since thanks are being spread around, we would like to do the same. And we'd like to start by thanking you, Chair Beyer, for the catalyst you were in getting this process started, Senators Atkinson and Burdick for their guidance and leadership throughout the stakeholder group. We'd like to also thank the Commission, especially Commissioner Ackerman and Commission staff, Carla Bird, for their leadership in getting this process done. And I'd be remiss if I didn't thank the stakeholder group for holding it together. We had some hard times. It was difficult at times, but we did it. And I don't think there's anyone sitting here before you right now that thought at the beginning of this session we would be here doing this, but it's been a gratifying situation. Avista is in complete agreement with the proposal that the stakeholder group worked out, and Avista agrees with the joint testimony you just heard from Commissioner Ackerman. We support Senate Bill 967 and urge the committee to move it to work session as soon as possible into the Senate floor. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Early.
Chairman Beyer, committee members, I'm Michael Early. I'm the Executive Director of the Industrial Customers of Northwest Utilities. We have a number of members served by Pacific Corps and by Portland General Electric in Oregon. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 967. I want to express my appreciation to the chair for behind the scenes guiding this process forward to a successful resolution. I want to thank the other committee members for their help and assistance. I want to express my appreciation to Commissioner Ackerman and express our appreciation for her guidance in bringing the parties together, and we look forward to working with the commissioners in implementing this new bill. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. This is all going to start sounding very familiar, I think. We too.
Could you put your name on the record, please?
Marion Haynes with Portland General Electric. We too support Senate Bill 967 and the joint testimony that was submitted by Commissioner Ackerman. We'd also like to thank Senators Atkinson and Burdick, as well as Commissioner Ackerman and the PUC staff for all their significant work on this effort. And we are pleased to support Senate Bill 967. Thank you.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you all. And let's see, Bob Jinks, Scott Bolton, and Paula Pyron.
Chairman Beyer, members of the committee, My name is Bob Jenks, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. We support the bill, urge the committee to pass it. I want to give you one example of the problem we're trying to solve. Right now, when we set utility rates, we forecast costs. We forecast taxes. We forecast fuel. We forecast power prices. We forecast health care costs, really everything. And we're not really as good at forecasting as Senator Atkinson, and because we're always wrong. The one thing we're pretty sure of after we forecast costs into a test year is we're going to be wrong, and the costs end up being higher or lower. And in the end, what that means is the rates, sometimes we set the rates too high. Sometimes we set the rates too low. In some cases, we'll estimate the costs will be lower than we projected, revenues will be greater, and in the end, the utility will earn more than its rate of return. And in utility rate making, what that means is customers have paid more than they ought to. They paid the utility's costs. They paid the utility's rate of return. That's all customers are obliged to pay under utility rate making, and then they paid a little bit more because we got the cost wrong. What 408 does is says when you do that, the utility is going to have an additional tax payment because of that over-earning, because of that excess payment customers made, the utility is going to have to pay more taxes. And so the utility gets to come to the customer and ask the customer to make up that extra taxes. Now, the way the analogy for that is if you went to a grocery store and spent $10 but gave them a $20 bill, they didn't realize it, gave you change, thinking you gave you a $10 bill, and then you get out and realize you overpaid $10. You go back into the store, and they say, well, yeah, you did overpay $10, but under state law, we get to put you a 40% surcharge on that, which is the effective tax rate, so you owe us $4 more. That's really the effect of the true-up for an over-earning utility, and that's one of the problems we've had. We see getting rid of the true-up as a solution. Again, we think we need to, at the PUC, look at tax structures and how that impacts taxes so we don't create another Enron problem. We think this bill allows us to do that, getting rid of the worst examples that we think require customers to overpay after they've already overpaid. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, Scott Bolton on behalf of Pacific Corp. Again, never thought I'd be sitting up here reveling in the amount of goodwill that this bill has engendered, considering its history. But we echo all the thanks to the participants and stakeholders, and we believe the bill reflects important principles that balance both the need for utility investment as well as protecting the public interest. And returning taxes as back to the rate-making function, so taxes as a cost component can be examined and looked at and argued over in context, is the right thing to do. It does protect customers. It also protects the integrity of rate-making, and we support that change. And I'll just leave it at that unless you have questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Paula?
Chairman Beyer and Senators, I am Paula Pyron. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Industrial Gas Users, and we have members who are take service behind Northwest Natural and Avista, as well as other utilities in the Northwest. I'm just here to echo the support that you've heard from the other participants for Senate Bill 967, as well as expressly for the joint testimony. I feel the same as everybody else. I would not have predicted this, and am appreciative of the efforts of Senator Atkinson and Senator Burdick in helping us get here, and particularly for Commissioner Ackerman and Carla Bird of the staff in helping us try to find that common ground together, which we have in this bill. This doesn't change the intent, but it does reach a better method in application, and we're here to support that. And I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you. Senator Girard.
All right. Scott, I'm sorry you won the jackpot here. I got a couple questions for you. And if you don't have a bill, that you just say you don't know. But these sections require utility rates to include current and deferred income taxes and other related tax items. What does the phrase other related tax items mean?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Girard, I believe in the context of the proposals that led to the crafting of this of Senate Bill 967, really it was to anticipate anything. It's a catch-all. Really, current and deferred taxes, to my knowledge, include the panoply of tax items that would be considered in a rate case. But in case we miss something, we want to make sure that all aspects of income taxes or tax components would be examining included.
So for follow-up, there's also the phrase, all expected current and deferred tax balances and tax credits shall be made in setting rates. What are expected taxes?
Senator, that refers, I think, that touches on the question that you asked Commissioner Ackerman earlier. I think when it's expected, that's in the context of a historic test period as you're forecasting all of your cost components for rate making.
There's just some people wanted this on the record. Thank you.
You bet.
It's a good bill.
No more questions?
No, I'm done.
Hold on. Senator Atkinson, you already had your chance to ask questions.
Mr. Bolton, can you define the word panoply?
No, I don't believe I can.
We're working on it.
A complete array.
Anything else?
I can't let that go.
That was great.
Nice. Thank you very much.
Panoply, that you just made my book.
So that's all that I have signed up for testifying on this bill, Senate Bill 967. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, we do not, as I say, have the fiscal on this one, so we cannot act on it today. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 967. I know. That's where we're going next. And Senator Nelson is here, so we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 955. Senator, good to have you out.
Well, thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, and State Senator from District 29 out in Northeast Oregon, and this bill is a reflection of the concern that some of my constituents have about the renewable portfolio standard and what the effects of some of the laws that we have passed in the past are going to affect them. Even to electric co-op folks, you guys want to come up and sit here? Yeah, come on up here. Yeah. So
what?
Basically, with this, what's going to be happening out in our part of the country, and these folks can explain it a little bit better, is the fact that they will be under the renewable portfolio standard greater than 3%, which basically is going to cost ratepayers money. And they're in comparison to very many of the size of other utility companies. I think there's something around 13,000 or 14,000 ratepayers, and next highest is Eugene, I think, with 85, and then you get up into Pacific Power and PGE, and that's a huge amount of money. Yeah. Part of the situation, there's some growth out there, and then there's some non-growth, and so part of the growth that's coming in is, according to the East Oregonian, that we have a local newspaper that Amazon may be coming in to develop two call centers, one at the Port of Morrow, I think, and one at the Port of Umatilla, and that's going to probably, with that power usage involved, is going to kick them over the 3%, and so it's going to cause, they have to meet some of those portfolio standards, and it's going to cause excess costs on our consumers. And so I'm here representing the consumers, and I'll let these folks from Umatilla Electric present their case, and you can get me off here.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I am an attorney with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Umatilla Electric Cooperative. With me also is Mr. Steve Eldridge, who is the general manager and CEO of Umatilla Electric Cooperative, who will elaborate on my introductory statement. We are here in support of Senate Bill 955. We want to thank Senator Nelson for bringing this issue to the committee and for his leadership in our part of the state. When the renewable portfolio standards were enacted in 2007, and no one anticipated the collapse of the economy and the ravages of the recession, especially in eastern Oregon. The general economic decline east of the mountains, coupled with the loss of jobs associated with the Umatilla Army Depot decommissioning, and then the additional loss of potential employment and tax base, which may well follow Boardman decommissioning, has created a perfect storm, resulting in the highest unemployment which these counties have seen in years. In 2007, when the RPS was enacted by the legislature, Umatilla Electric Cooperative was considered a small utility with approximately 14,000 meters and less than 80 employees, serving 6.5 customers per line mile. Today, that is still true. We've distributed a number of handouts. One of them talks about Senate Bill 955, and on it there's a chart. And if you reference the chart, you can compare our 6.5 customers per distribution mile and 13,968 customers to Portland General's, which is 45.2 customers per distribution mile with a total of 815,869 customers. Pacific Power's 29.3 customers per distribution mile, 555,069 customers, and eWeb's 78.5 customers per distribution mile, or 86,720 customers. The Umatilla Army Depot is being decommissioned. We will lose more than 600 jobs between 2012 and 2015. Hundreds of those job losses will be in Umatilla, Morrow, and Union counties. In addition, PGE has agreed to close the Boardman coal plant in 2020, which is 20 years earlier than its 2040 useful life. This could reduce employment by another 110 full-time jobs if another use is not found for the facility. The jobs at the Army Depot and the Boardman coal plant are some of the highest paying in the region. A variety of economists and the governor have mentioned that one job in rural Oregon is equivalent to 125 jobs in the metro area. So to put this in perspective, job losses of 600 to 700 in that region multiplied by 125 would be equivalent to 75,000 to 87,000 job losses in the metro area. The economic impact of losing just 100 jobs is huge, not just for the unemployed, but for the businesses that serve them as well. Now, undaunted, Umatilla Electric Cooperative and its regional partners, which are the ports, cities, and counties, have worked hard to attract new business to the area. Umatilla Electric has been instrumental in locating a large server farm, which will occupy three sites in Morrow and Umatilla counties. These server farms can be anchors for future business from the very same companies, but they are heavy energy users. And as Mr. Eldridge will elaborate, just adding this one new business that plans to occupy these three sites in our service area will put us in the large utility RPS category by 2013. Now, Umatilla Electric's customers are already scheduled to see rate increases in 2012 of between 7% and 11% due to increases in BPA's rate design. And now they could potentially face another 4% because they may be classified as large load RPS utility customers. We're sort of an aberration because we are right on the cusp, and we find ourselves in a quandary. If we serve our community acting as an engine for economic development, we then place more pressure on our electric customers who are already having problems paying their electric bills. For that reason, Senator Nelson has been kind enough to sponsor Senate Bill 955. What the bill does is it defines a Boardman-impacted utility as a cooperative corporation that is the holder of a minority interest in the Boardman plant. Now, that happens to be the Power Resources Cooperative, which has a minority interest in the Boardman plant. Subsection 2, sub 2 says, an electric utility will remain subject to the small electric utility classification if it is a member of a Boardman impacted utility, and the Umatilla Electric Cooperative is a member of the Power Resources Cooperative, and if it serves 25,000 or fewer electric utility customers in Umatilla, Morrow, or Union counties. And so it's a very specific bill. It is not a bill of general application. It's specific pretty much to us. We're the only ones who would be impacted by it. And that is because we truly believe we're an aberration. We are a utility on the cusp that is being very successful in economic development. The people in our region are very hard hit. And the last thing we want to do is have our efforts prejudiced by even higher electric rates for our customers. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn this over to Mr. Eldridge, who may comment on how we get there to 2013.
Before we do, John, did you speak to the dash ones?
We've just received the dash amendments.
They're
from Portland General Electric. I think they. I haven't fully analyzed them. I believe the purpose. Their purpose is to. It was one of definition. It's. I am told to still include us in the bill, make us the only party included in the bill, but to suggest that what we're impacted by are economic conditions in the city of Boardman as opposed to anything that may or may not happen at the Boardman coal-fired plant. That's my understanding of the purposes of the amendments. I have not yet reviewed them to make absolutely sure that we're protected, but that's what I understand they do, and maybe someone from PGE will want to speak to those.
Okay. Mr. Eldridge?
Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. My name is Steve Eldridge from Hermiston, Oregon, the manager of Umatilla Electric Cooperative. And what I would like to do is put a little framework around what John said and explain why this is likely that the load will be there and it will push us prematurely into the 3% large utility arena. The state and port districts brought this customer to us first in 2008, and we were competing against Pacific Core and three other sites that we know of in Oregon. And ultimately, we're told by this customer that we were their preferred provider. And so we asked them what kind of energy needs they would have, and the number they gave us was 1.5 times our current size. Well, then the Great Recession struck, and they pretty much closed up. They had started building the building. They stopped all construction and didn't even say goodbye and left the area. Earlier in 2010, they came back and said they would now, instead of having one site, one very large site with triple redundancy electrical service, they believed that they could meet the reliability standards by diversifying sites. Two main sites, maybe two more, they just didn't know. It depended on how these new cloud businesses took off. That was one. Their customers, I think primarily due to latency and familiarity with these data centers, decide whether or not to put their business in a new site. And so it's a little unclear just how that's developed. But generally, data servers end up being 40 megawatts apiece or thereabouts. There's a real large one. Microsoft is building in Quincy that's supposed to be the largest building in the world when they're done. We'll see if that actually happens or not. I just don't know about that. So we think that there's a couple possibilities on the load growth. Now, irrespective of this data farm, our particular area has grown a little faster than the state over the period of time from 2007. We started out at about a little under 1.7% of sales in 2007. Now we're almost 2, even though last year was less sales. For the period, we're still creeping up without the server farms. So we think that there's a very high likelihood that these server farms are going to push us over. And so the problem is that under the current rules, we have to provide 10% of new renewables by 2025. And at 3%, it's 25. That has a net present value of $41 million in additional cost. The difference between being at 10% or 25%. And it's $56 million additional wholesale power cost if we weren't under the RPS at all. Well, that's coming from customers that now earn an average of 22% less than the state average wages and 31% less than Portland area wages. And as John said earlier, hundreds of jobs are going to be lost in the next 5 to 10 years. And as far as I know, there's no plans to reestablish those jobs. For a while, it looked like PGE was going to build a combined cycle combustion turbine at the current Boardman site, which would have at least helped with the lost tax base. But their latest IRP, as I understand it, doesn't call for a combined cycle combustion turbine, but rather peaker plants to follow the wind that they're investing in. We don't know what kind of jobs those are going to be. We don't know what the location is. It does not appear that the tax base or the jobs will come back, at least in that form. For the Army Depot, which was built about the time we entered World War II, it's been a large employer for quite a number of years. You may know, as these are decommissioned, they form a local land use authority. And they have done that. The federal government has not made a final decision on how they're going to hand that property over. They haven't decided if they're going to provide any funding. It doesn't look like they're going to. And so whether or not that 5-square-mile of site out in the middle of Umatilla and Morrill County will be developed commercially, industrial, we just don't know. So the other thing that is presenting itself, and I don't know how well this was understood in 2007, but in 2007 and for 60 years prior to that, when we had load growth, the next kilowatt hour pretty much cost the same as every other kilowatt hour. Now, in October, we enter an era in which we have been assigned a high water mark, our share of the federal-based system. Every kilowatt hour beyond that will be at new market-based rates, which are 50% higher in and of themselves in comparison to the legacy generation. The transition for our particular company to this new power environment will raise our rates, our wholesale cost, by 11%. We don't want to forget that Bonneville also has a cost recovery adjustment clause of 18%, which at the moment has a low probability of triggering, but it's not zero. And it'll be driven by market price, how many surplus energy sales that Bonneville can make to subsidize the rates of the Northwest, and how much water is available. This year looks pretty good. Next year, who knows? The other thing that is being established is that Bonneville now will have each 2 years an adjustment to their rates, and I believe adjustment to the conditions of the contract, because we have a brand new contract, an evolving energy field, has a lot of uncertainty that really will begin in October of this year. So in summary, it seems counterintuitive to me to require a non-generating, non-emitting distribution electric cooperative with 10,000 members who is presently 90% renewable from federal-based hydro system to meet the same standards as Pacific Core and Portland General Electric. And that could happen by us being designated a large utility under the RPS standards. And being designated in this way will have no effect on carbon reduction. Rather, its only effect are the adverse economic ones in Eastern Oregon. Thank you.
Questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you, gentlemen. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Brendan McCarthy.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy representing Portland General Electric. Portland General Electric is an investor-owned utility. We serve 822,000 customers in the Northern Willamette Valley, six counties. We serve 52 cities. We're subject to the large utility standard and under RPS. We are also the majority owner of the Boardman coal-fired facility located near the city of Boardman, 65% owner of that facility. As some of you may know, we have just completed a lengthy process that involved both the DEQ and the PUC. The company is now on a path to cease burning coal at that facility by the end of 2020. I want to be clear, that's our mandate, that we cease burning coal, not that the facility close. We are actively investigating other uses of the Boardman facility and fervently hope that we are able to reuse the facility in some manner, including retaining many of the jobs that are currently there. So we understand what Umatilla Electric Cooperative is trying to do here. We empathize with the and understand the potential economic problems that would be caused by eliminating 110 full-time jobs in that county. We think, though, that there's a different way to approach this bill. We've offered the dash ones, which tie what they're trying to do only to the economic development that's happening that pushes them over the 3% standard, rather than also tying it to the coal facility that we're the majority owner of. I also need to just correct a little bit of the testimony. We're currently looking at a capacity resource and a baseload resource to fulfill our energy needs in the coming 5 years and longer. Capacity resource out near Port Westward and a baseload resource potentially out near the Boardman facility itself, which we've called a Cardi facility. Both of those will go to RFP this year, and if chosen, we would expect that we would, through that process, we would expect that we would build the Cardi facility there near Boardman. Now, that would be about, hard to say exactly, but we're using a comparative to our Port Westward facility, which employs about 17 full-time employees and is about 400 megawatts. So that's what we're, you know, ballpark. I don't want to draw a direct comparison because it could be different, but ballpark is what we'll be looking at. And
what was the number?
Which number?
Of employees, you said?
I think there are 17 at Port Westward full-time. And with that, I conclude my testimony. If you have any questions about the dash ones, I'd be happy to answer them if possible.
I'm trying to figure out what they do, Brendan.
Mr. Chair, we're changing the definition of Boardman impacted utility to directly refer to a utility that serves the city of Boardman and expects to see increased economic development in the area. The title of the bill is Boardman Impacted Utility, so it was fairly difficult to remove the definition entirely. So my goal was to change the definition such that it referred to the situation that UEC is seeing, which is the potential increased economic development, and remove any reference to the coal-fired facility.
Okay. All right. Any questions of Brendan? Thank you, Brendan.
Thank you.
All right, now I've got a list of people, so I'll take the three at a time. Jeff Bissonette, Margie Hoffman, and Ellen Tressider. There's Ellen.
He's grabbing some.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette. I'm here representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. We are a statewide collaboration of consumer groups, environmental organizations, human service agencies, clean energy businesses, faith groups, and labor that work to address energy policy in the state. I will note that neither of us are Margie Hoffman. She was called to another hearing and was going to testify on behalf of Renewable Northwest Project in opposition to the bill, and she asked me to express that if she didn't make it back. I'm here today to testify in opposition to Senate Bill 955. When the renewable energy standard was being developed in 2007, we were trying to craft a statewide policy that tried to direct, as our state's load grew, as our state's energy usage grew, that we were defining how we were going to meet that load. We were going to meet it the same way we have in the past. Were we going to invest more in fossil fuels? Could we invest in clean energy? And the policy statement that Oregon made in the passage of Senate Bill 838 back in 2007 was that we were going to try and push renewable energy resources to meet future load. We could keep that load growth under control by investing more in energy efficiency, and the more you invest in energy efficiency, the lower your load growth and the fewer amount of renewable resources you would have to invest in to meet the renewable energy standard. I think that you heard testimony that, you know, we had one utility that was sort of on the cusp, and that utility was Umatilla Electric Co-op, and actually got put into the smaller utility category. But their load is growing, and if their load is growing through their successful economic development efforts, then they, they need to recognize that and make sure that they follow the state policy and meet that new responsibility under the standard. One thing I do want to highlight is that the impression that one might get from listening to the testimony from the supporters is that the moment they hit 3%, they're automatically under the 25% by 2025 standard. That's not the case. If you look at the bill as it was signed, a utility that on the date of the passage is serving less than 3% of all electricity then goes above that, they have to have that same load met for three consecutive years until they've fallen to that standard. And then it is only after the calendar year, after the three subsequent calendar years, that they start to be eligible for meeting the increased standard. And then it is not until the fourth calendar year that they have to meet the first benchmark, which is 5% of state load, 5% of their load met by renewable energy. And so I did a little math based on that. And if the testimony was from the representatives of Umatilla Electric Co-op is correct, and they're going to meet their 3% of state load by 2013, they would have to maintain that in 2013, 2014, and 2015. It would then be in 2016 that they're subject to the standard, if all of that holds. And then it would not be until 2020 that they have to be at 5% of the state load. So again, this is not something that happens automatically. One of the things that we anticipated in developing the renewable portfolio standard is that a utility that reaches the threshold needs time to grow into it. And again, looking at the information provided by Umatilla Electric Co-op, they are currently at other sources, including renewable, at 2.2%. I don't know what percentage of the 2.2% is renewable or new renewable, but I suspect it's a fair chunk of that. And so if they're already halfway to the 5% mark that they might be subject to by 2020, they're already doing pretty far along. And again, just to give people a sense of the other benchmarks, they would have to be at 15% by 2026, 20% by 2031, and 25% by 2036. So again, the policy as written gives them time to grow in, and again, they can still be in compliance if the investments needed start to exceed the rate cap of 4%, which is a protection that all utility customers in the state have. With that, I will conclude my testimony. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Ms. Schrester.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Alan Tresseter, and I'm here representing Iberdrola Renewables. We are one of the largest renewable energy companies in the world, headquartered in Spain with U.S. headquarters in Portland, Oregon. We have invested over $2 billion in Oregon renewable energy projects in less than a decade, and we have plans to do that over the next decade also. We have utility-size wind projects, we have some small solar projects, and we're in the process of building a relatively large biomass facility in Lakeview. Why do we invest in Oregon? Why did Iberdrola come to Oregon? Three reasons. The wind blows here, not as great as someplace, but it does blow. We had the business energy tax credit, and we had the RPS. The RPS is a great reason to build renewable energy so that it is available for everyone else that's trying to meet these RPS standards. The Betsy is going to go away for utility-sized wind. We know that, we understand that, and we've prepared for that. Let's not start watering down renewable portfolio standards. We were all in this together in 2007 when we adopted the standards. We all worked together to develop what they would be and what they would look like. This cannot have been a surprise to Umatilla. I mean, the standards are the standards, and they understood they came in under a small utility, and if you grow, you grow out of that shell that you're in. And as Jeff just described to you, this doesn't kick in for them for quite some time. I mean, they have plenty of time to plan and do this, and we would urge you to not pass this measure, that it's important that we go forward with the RPS as it is written, and we planned this together, we're implementing this together, let's stay together on this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions?
One question.
Senator Atkinson.
I don't know if this is the only question. I was here for all the RPS work and renewable portfolios, and I don't know if it's common knowledge to this committee or if you made this aware to other committees, Mr. Bissonnette, but your family has increased its own RPS, and I think that you should tell everyone what has visited your house lately by the way of the store, so that we can all formally congratulate you and embarrass you on the record.
Well, thank you, Senator Atkinson. I appreciate that. What the senator is referring to is my wife and I had our first child, boy, Elijah, on the 19th of February. So as of Saturday, he'll be 7 weeks old, and both mom and baby are doing well, and the jury's still out on dad. So.
And the renewable portfolio standard lives on. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
You bet.
Let's see here. Two more. Andrea and I think it's Paul Wooden.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Paul Wooden. I'm Executive Director of the Community Renewable Energy Association. We're a Chapter 190 intergovernmental agency. Amongst our members, we have a number of Oregon counties and a number of small development companies interested in community renewables. In our role of supporting our members, we spend quite a bit of time with the counties, not just on community projects, but also helping them interface with the larger renewable companies. So I'm fairly intimate about the knowledge of what's taking place in Morrow County. Umatilla's attorney painted a very bleak picture about employment. I'm not too sure that I see the county in the same light. The Boardman plant, if they follow the intents of what PGE is hoping to do, will be transitioned from a coal plant to a biomass plant of comparable capacity. We've just finished negotiating a strategic investment program with PGE from Morrow County for the Cardi gas plant, which Brenda McCarty just mentioned. The new load growth from the server farm brings additional employment. It is true the Umatilla, our weapons depot, will be shutting down over time, but there's a lot of vibrant growth in the Port of Morrow and in Morrow County. So I don't know that if you were to talk to Judge Tallman that he would paint quite as bleak a picture about employment in the county. I'm here to testify against Senate Bill 955 for a number of reasons. As was mentioned earlier, the 2007 Renewable Energy Standard was crafted to define the renewable standards for regulated utilities, which includes co-ops, PUDs, and munis. In the standard were defined provisions to address when a small utility would be fortunate enough to gain enough load growth to move them up into the next category. And this appears as a possibility with Umatilla Co-op. Our organization was part of the coalition that helped draft the requirements of the Renewable Energy Standard. And as was stated by Jeff Bissonette, this contingency was already addressed and approved by a bipartisan amount of the legislature. While on the surface it appears that Senate Bill 955 is trying to address a specific issue with Umatilla Co-op, it really opens up a door that I don't think we would prefer to see happen, because what it's doing is it's reopening up the standards established in the Renewable Energy Standard. And if, in fact, Umatilla is capable of changing the provisions, it opens up the door for all of the other co-ops to approach it the same way. The intent of the Renewable Energy Standard is that for new load growth, at least 25% of it be from renewables. I've got to talk a little bit about what load growth means. In today's environment, load growth really comes from two different areas. It either comes from new gas plants or it comes from renewables. There will probably never be another large hydro system in the Northwest. We know that coal at this point is very unlikely, particularly based on what just happened in Japan. We don't see nuclear on the horizon. There really only leaves one type of load growth of fossil base, and that's gas. The other one is renewables. And what the standard says is that if you're fortunate enough to see load growth, 75% of it will probably be gas plant. The other 25% should be renewables. Now, Umatilla gave a very passionate plea as to how much their requirement for renewables would increase their cost to the customer. Well, that's true of all load growth. The next generations of gas plants are going to increase the rate also. There is no free ride. The best power we have are the hydro dams, but they're fully subscribed. So any increase in load growth is automatically an increase in customer rate base. So to say that renewables are going to drive us off of the edge is only a partial truth. The other side of it is if they go straight gas, they're going to increase their rates also. So we resist the thought of Senate Bill 955. We think it opens up doors that we don't want to go down, and it really doesn't gain them anything in cost because they're going to pay for it, whether it's gas or renewables. So thank you for my opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Andrea?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC opposes SB 955. We are part of the original coalition that helped develop the RPS agreement. We believe that the RPS agreement, as crafted, was a strong agreement for the environment, and we believe that SB 955, as proposed, would weaken environmental provisions under the RPS. And as testimony has been presented today with these policy experts, we would like to see this bill opposed. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Succinct. Seeing none, thank you very much.
That is all I have to testify, signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, do I have anything else to read in? So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill, was it 955, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 863.
Senate Bill 863 directs the Public Utility Commission to report on strategies for increasing heating and energy bill assistance to low-income families. We also have a Guttenstuff Dash 2 amendment, which requires the Public Utility, requires at the Public Utility Commission's direction, an electric company or Oregon Community Power to collect an additional $5 million for low-income electric bill payment assistance. There's no revenue impact on the original bill, and I don't have a fiscal on either the amendment or the original bill or revenue impact on the amendment.
Okay, Mr. Bissonnette, Kincaid, and McCarthy.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Brendan McCarthy representing Portland General Electric. Coming to you today, asking the committee to give their approval to Senate Bill 863. This bill started off with a conversation at our executive level with a desire to see what could be done given current economic situation, given a potential reduction in LIHEAP dollars, what else we could do to help low-income bill payers pay their bill. We started a conversation then with CAPO, which was very productive, and we decided to move forward with this bill concept that would increase the meter charge, and we would tie it to some economic factors. We would allow the increase to happen periodically and be limited in scope, to sort of plug the holes if there were any, keeping the baseline amount that the legislature adopted in 2007 at $15 million, but allowing a temporary increase in the amount. As we continued our conversations with the Citizens Utility Board and others, we decided to actually make it a temporary provision just to deal with the current downturn. And what we think we have is a pretty good product that, especially considering the expected reduction in LIHEAP dollars from the federal government, will plug some of the holes, but not all the holes, for our low-income bill payers. We are still working on some jits and toddles with the help of Lee Sparling at the PUC, and expect to probably have a different set of amendments coming at you. But beyond that, the substance of the bill is still the same.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon, and we represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. We have supported the energy assistance charge because for a couple of reasons. One, it's kind of the humanitarian thing to do, but also, two, it has a system benefit. The fewer times that we have people sort of going on and off the system, the cheaper the cost is for all ratepayers. And I have to say that we were a little bit troubled by the original proposal as put forth that kind of changed the policy where all ratepayers kind of kick in a little bit into bill payment assistance again, because it is a system cost and a system benefit to keep folks on. The original proposal just had the residential ratepayers paying for this. And that was a
precedent that we were uncomfortable with, but in talking about it with our board, and I'll give credit where credit is due, we thought that we could still help sort of close the gap that Brendan referred to in terms of the loss of a significant amount of federal funds coming for bill payment assistance. Oregon stands to lose up to $20 million. This would close a little bit of that gap by up to five, but we thought we could go along with this concept if both the our responsibility for it and the program itself were time limited, and so that is what the bill is before you, and so it's $5 million a year for a maximum of 2 years, and then this section of the statute would then be repealed automatically on January 1st, 2014. I think it's also important to note that other parts of the bill, which are not permanent, give a greater role and a greater voice both to the utilities themselves and also the customers to try and see if there are better ways to apply the funds that are coming in as part of the permanent program to get better information, reporting information from the Department of Housing and Community Services, who administers these programs. And that will be an ongoing benefit, I think, to both the utility companies and the customers we represent. So we are happy to be here in support of Senate Bill 863 and happy to answer questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jess Kincaid. I'm the Energy Coordinator for Community Action Partnership of Oregon. Our association works in partnership with community action agencies. We work with utilities, nonprofits, and state government to deliver energy assistance funding. Last year, we were able to serve over 100,000 households in Oregon. We're here in support of Senate Bill 863 because it will do three primary things. First, it will raise $5 million in energy assistance each year for the next 2 years. We feel this is necessary given the current state of the economy. Since 2008, we've seen a literal doubling of requests for energy assistance each year over the next. The first week of January this year, we had 56,000 requests for energy assistance. Again, in comparison, we were able to serve just over 100,000 households last year. Second, as Mr. Bissonnette mentioned, this bill will also encourage more collaboration between the agencies that deliver the services, the utilities whose customers we serve, and our partners in the community. And thirdly, it will give us better information on the impacts of the program so that we are able to look at both the data that's compiled by Oregon Housing and Community Services on the clients that we serve, but also the data that utilities compile, how their customers, both individually and combined, benefit from the services of the program. We really want to thank our partners in collaborating on this effort, and I'm happy to hear any questions that you may have.
Thank you.
Richard, just for the record, you guys are all in general support of the Dash 2 amendments of the bill, is what you guys are testifying in support of, or are you talking about the original bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 2s are the current going amendment, yes, but we believe, working with the PUC, that there are probably some minor changes that will need to be clarification points mostly. So we'll see a Dash 3 or a Dash 4.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all that I have signed up to testify on. On 863, is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Some things for the record.
Yeah, several written testimony from Northwest Energy Coalition, from Community Action Partnership, another community action group, and another community action group, all in support of the measure.
Okay. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 863, and we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 264.
264 is a very complicated measure dealing with access management. So I'm not going to read the entire staff measure summary, but there's an original bill, and then there is a large gut and stuff. We don't have the fiscal revenue on the dash one amendments. We also have something to submit it in the record, a letter from Rep. Doherty in support of the bill.
Wonderful. Mr. Garrett, Mr. Bryan, do you want to start this off?
Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and with me is Bob Bryant. Bob has been on placed on point by my department on the access management issues and was carrying the ODOT flag as the lead member of the Access Management Committee. Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do is just do some maybe introductory remarks and then turn it to Mr. Bryant to speak to some of the procedural changes. But the bottom line is we certainly found ourselves in an environment where we could help shape our future or we could react to a future specific to access management. The jump-off point was certainly a piece of legislation coming out of the 2010 February supplemental session, House Bill 1024. And what that charged us with doing was to come together with stakeholders, assemble folks, and move forward in developing, clarifying, and codifying the way we issue access permits using objective standards. The bottom line, there was a critique that the way my agency did this across the state was not uniform, was not consistent, and there was ambiguity. So using these objective standards, we take that away, and where there was confusion, we now have clarity. The second charge coming out of 1024 spoke to less stringent standards, access management rules, mitigation measures, spacing and mobility standards on those segments of highway that carry traffic of about 5,000 vehicles or less. With that as the jump-off point, the language we have before you and the work of the Access Management Committee responds to this direction. From an agency perspective, being one member of this overall committee, what I directed my folks to bring to the table was an attitude and a disposition to find a balance between safety and operations and economic development. Our primary focus prior to this engagement was primarily on the operations of the transportation asset, the safety issues surrounding that. We have now placed the new variable in this equation to seek that balance, find a sweet spot between these three type issues. We move forward in moving requirements and standards into statute versus rules or versus in our policies. And then we place the onus on my agency to identify the safety and operational concerns rather than placing that onus on the developers. Simply put, we're moving in a new direction here. We're going to accept some risk. There is no question as we open up opportunity for economic development to bloom and access to the highways, there is a risk of more congestion and the collateral issues that come with congestion. So we enter this conversation with our eyes wide open. I will tell you, Mr. Chairman, that my agency, again, one of many representing this committee, but my agency is comfortable with the language that is contained in Senate Bill 264, the Dash 1 amendments. We acknowledge the risks. More importantly, we stand ready to implement the committee's proposal. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Bryant to kind of deep dive into some of the procedural issues that are contained within the document.
Gentlemen, if you would allow me to invite Senator Johnson up briefly. I think she wanted to testify, and I know she was deeply involved in this. Senator Johnson, would you like to testify? Welcome, Senator. Thank you for your work on this.
Well, this has been a long time in the coming. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I am the state senator from District 16. I want to thank Mr. Garrett for his efforts in bringing us this bill today, and I am extremely pleased that we are here with this bill. I know that Matt has taken a personal interest in the bill. He and I have had a couple of, how would I characterize those, Matt, robust conversations. But I appreciate his willingness to jump in at a couple of times when it got stuck. While I'm pleased to be here today, getting here has been a challenge. Nobody disputes the primary goal of access management is to allow access to our state's highways while at the same time maintaining mobility. The problem we face is that the process is broken. I think practically every legislator in this building has an access management horror story to tell. While this bill is just one step in fixing the problem, I think it's a very big and important step. For me, the development of this bill began in the fall of 2009, when many in this room met to discuss the difficulties associated with access management. Then, during the 2010 short session, we passed Senate Bill 1024 that established objective standards for change of use and directed the department to work with stakeholders to develop additional legislation. The bill before you is the result of that enormous effort. From my perspective, the most important aspect of Senate Bill 264 is the significant change to the process of access management. By establishing objective standards, nearly 80% of future access applications will be approved as a matter of course. The remaining 20%, we will establish a collaborative process and a new unbiased appeals process to resolve any of the disputes. These changes alone make the bill a winner, but we didn't stop there, and in just a few minutes, I think Mark Whitlow is going to come up and explain some of the details of the bill. A couple of weeks ago, I was reminded of why this bill is so important as I attended a series of access management discussions in Woodburn with the knowledge of the president, so you don't think I was freeloading in his district. He knew I was there, concerning a bank whose access the department was proposing to remove as part of a project to rebuild the interchange on I-5. The meeting was extremely contentious. At one point, ODOT employees suggested that the property could simply be redeveloped as a dentist's office. Needless to say, this was a surprise to the bank president, who had no intention of returning to school to become a dentist. While the bill is definitely a step in the right direction, our work is not done. The department and the stakeholders need to continue their work to reform the access management system. The bill sets up an oversight task force that includes members of the legislature to make sure the changes in the bill are the right ones and to oversee additional changes that we might consider during future legislative sessions. While there are many people who participated in the development of this bill, I especially want to thank Senator Verger, Senator Whitsitt, Representative Beyer, and Representative Doherty for their participation in the stakeholder committee meetings. I would like to thank the OTC chair, Gail Achterman, and again, Director Garrett, for recognizing that there is a problem and their genuine willingness to address it. In addition, I want to thank Mark Whitlow and ODOT's Victor Dodier for putting paper to pen and taking many of the ideas and turning them into the bill before you. And finally, I want to acknowledge our facilitator, Del Huntington, for keeping the discussions on track. Though this bill represents a work in progress, I respectfully ask that you pass the bill to the floor of the Senate. In my humble opinion, this could be one of the most important pieces of transportation legislation that we consider this session. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Atkinson.
Thank you. I certainly want to recognize, in fact, I was speaking this morning, that the only time someone calls their senator is when something really bad has happened. Almost no
That's
one,
just you. My guy's calling.
Almost no one calls us with good news. And so certainly out of deference to Mr. Garrett, who wasn't at that meeting, but I do know of that one horror story that you speak about, of where the access to the bank and the trustee is in her 90s and she's supposed to redevelop this or just be told to sell it or change a high access access bank into a dentist office. Will this bill resolve that? Have we resolved that? Is that no longer a problem? Do we have a personality conflict? Do we have a inability to have the meeting of the mind? Or are we about to pass a bill that doesn't fix that?
If I may, Director, Senator Johnson. With regard to the bank
and
the project,
Bob.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Bob Bryant with the Oregon Department of Transportation, thank you. With regard to the project in Woodburn and West Coast Bank, the standards that have been established and introduced as legislation in this bill would not necessarily open a door for us to change the proposal to close the access at the location that it exists in on of R218 and 14 in Woodburn. The standards themselves with regard to spacing relative to an intersection or to a preceding driveway are exceeded on this segment of highway in Woodburn. That said, there's also the function and operation, the safety and operational issues that exist in Woodburn, which is the goal of the project, to try and reduce the congestion and the associated crash rate that exists in this on this section of highway as part of the Woodburn Interchange project. So, no, not in and of itself, the standards wouldn't have effect if they were in place today. The outcome of that, it's certainly not a personality issue. It's an investment, major public investment associated with the interchange, but extends as far east as Oregon Way to, again, address the safety and operational issues with regard to the current segment of highway.
Mr. Chair, if I could also make a comment. I think Mr. Bryant was there at one of the meetings that I attended. I think that there are lessons learned from Woodburn, and they are lessons that the district manager on behalf of ODOT has said that she'll incorporate into future thinking about these kinds of situations. Let me just give you an example, and that's why the call to action for a task force to keep working on this is so important. And that is the question, when you have a piece of property that has an owner and tenant, that ODOT doesn't always get the owner and the tenant together in the same room to have the discussions about access management because their interests could differ. But I think one of the lessons learned here is that you can't have only one half of that conversation. And I presume that that'll be one of the carry forwards. This really is a work in progress. And my genesis in the whole issue came at a time when Oregon was just entering the depths of the recession, and representatives from Safeway and Fred Meyer came to me and said, we'd like to do improvements on our stores, like build a new garden center or add new deli capacity, anticipating a time when Oregon comes out of the recession. But we are so frightened about changing the footprint of our building for fear that it will trigger access management issues, that at the very time we wanted Oregonians on the business end of a hammer, with jobs and looking to the future, businesses were too frightened to do it because they were worried about triggering traffic studies and access management issues. I think that Director Garrett and others in the management of ODOT would agree that this remains a problematic area for the agency. And rather than go back and try to figure out who's to blame at Woodburn, because there's plenty of blame to go around in my observation, I would rather see Senate Bill 264 as the beginning of a new day to start a new process to reconcile these issues and get objective standards in statute that allow developers to know what the rules are going to be and then to figure out a collaborative problem-solving mechanism to deal with the disputes in that smaller fraction of cases where the statute doesn't provide explicit instruction.
Well, my problem with that is, as a policymaker, is that we here are always asked to weigh in on land use all the time. Drives me crazy. We are, the legislature, in my estimation, has become the super school board and the super land use board. And so we apply, I see Randy back there, we look at metro, and we look at metro issues revolving density of housing, and then we try to apply that to Josephine County, and it doesn't necessarily work. And then we have LNG, and we have LNG proposals where we have eminent domain, and we're playing, and every session we're messing around with that one way or the other depending on the flavor of the week. And my concern here is that if we have the ability to devalue private property and we're just going to leave something in the wake, to me that the precedent there is nervous. So if we're saying, well,
state government's coming in and said, well, this is the good for all of Oregon, so we're going to devalue a piece of property. Rather than buying it, rather than going through eminent domain, we're just going to, bam, devalue it. To me, I mean, I'm not trying to make a molehill out of a bad example, but I think you know where I'm going. Eminent domain is a different process than an ODOT manager telling somebody just to redevelop. I mean, those are apples and oranges, and I don't want to cement a bad precedent in here.
Mr. Chair, may I respond? Given that I am sometimes want to use slightly hyperbolic language, I feel as though I need to correct the impression that I have left. This is not just devaluing the property, saying be a dentist's office and walking away. Eminent domain is clearly still on the table, as is appraisals that would contemplate the access that now exists rather than the diminished access to try to set a value. I think that bank is a somewhat unique situation. The planning has been going on there for a number of years. The bank has had this tragedy occur there, which supercharges that piece of property emotionally. But it isn't just we're going to turn your bank into a dentist's office. Good luck. All the options are still on the table. They may not be the most desirable options. And again, I don't want to rehash a private situation in too much more detail in public. There's plenty of blame to go around all the way here. I would submit that is somewhat of an anomalous situation, and I would commend to your serious consideration Senate Bill 264 to prohibit those kind of situations in the future. And while I can't say with certainty it'll prohibit them 100%, it'll sure go a long ways.
Senator, I think you're making a great point. Just a quick follow-up, not a question. But in my experience in land use over two centuries now, every situation is unique, and that's the problem. So I lay that out there and don't want to stand in the way of lots of compromise and task forces.
Mr.
Chair, maybe task forces, but not work groups.
If you'll allow me one more comment, this bill and its predecessor, 1024, go a long ways towards codifying some of the requirements so that developers will know what the rules are in advance going in and will stop this subjective, one-off, region-by-region determination, and will actually have some objective in-statute standards that will allow people a much higher degree of certainty to go ahead and make the economic improvements in their property. In the Freddy's and Safeway example that I gave to you. And I think that in the long run, although the agency has had a little trouble getting to this point at times, I think in the long run it's going to make everybody happier when you know what the rules are. Everybody wants to play by the rules. Just tell us what they are and don't let them change in and among five ODOT regions. The rules need to be the rules, and I think the agency will be happier because they won't be fighting these gunfights in the street over every one of these kinds of issues, and the legislature won't get so many calls from disgruntled constituents who say I didn't know what the deal was, and now all of a sudden here's ODOT saying I no longer have access to one of the major highways in the state.
Sure.
Thank you.
Director Garrett, in the amendment, is there enough flexibility for access management if we're talking about a Safeway in Ontario versus a Safeway in downtown Lakeview versus a Safeway in Tigard? I mean, one size fits all from a land use perspective, boy, scares the daylights out of me because it doesn't work.
Chair Beyer, co-chair Atkinson, it's always difficult to articulate objective standards in a black and white situation and then try to find flexibility. Okay, that's difficult. But I would suggest and submit we do have mechanisms in place that the one size fits all. And we spoke a little bit earlier about those highway segments of less than 5,000. You get to those segments, and we'll treat an urban and rural. That's really trying to address the urban and rural type situations because we have history from issues in Lakeview when, for all intents and purposes, we were trying to treat Lakeview the same way we would treat Portland or Pendleton. So while we have clear and objective standards articulated in here, there is the ability to navigate, to move in the appropriate direction to make things better, specific to a circumstance.
I'm done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Bob, I got the sense that you were going to delve into the details, and I'm going to stop that unless the committee wants to.
Put a motion to move the amendment?
No.
We can't. Well, we could do that, but I don't want to do that. But I do want to give people who are here a chance to, who've come for this chance to talk on it. We have to be out here at 5, and there's another coming in, and we still have two other bills that we may try to get to. So we'll have another chance because we can't move it today. So I'll give the committee a chance to look at these things and ask if you'll come back next time when we have this up. Thank you very much.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you, Senator, for all your hard work on this.
Thank you.
Del Huntington and Mark Whitlow.
Be back.
With Sean Miller.
Close the work session right now. David Jefferson bill is about to open. Go ahead.
You do it. Good afternoon, Vice Chair and Senators and Committee. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm Del Huntington, and I was had the honor of being the facilitator for this process that happened over the last year. There were a total of 25 members that were involved, another approximately 25 people that assisted the process, met over 30 times. And just really quickly with some background, there's about 15 states across the nation that have an access management program. However, none of those programs across the nation have any type of incentive for people to stay downtown. So with most access management programs, it's easiest for developers to go to the edge of the urban form where they can build the most easily, readily, and least expensive. Oregon, we have a different system here because we confine everything within the urban growth boundary. So attempting to balance and allow economic development to prosper and grow while remembering the economic form is critical. So, as a result, access management is more difficult to achieve here in Oregon than the rest of the nation. Just a real brief evolution. ODOT has managed access to highways since the 1950s. Then they developed access spacing in the 80s and then an access management rule in 2000. Some of the highlights of 264 is the culmination of this past year, but a couple of real key points is that with Senate Bill 264, you would not be determined to be denied if you have alternative access to the property. If you meet the standards under the new statute, you would be approved of a driveway. Another real large one that I believe will be get to some of the issues that Senator Johnson was speaking to would be to dissolve the current Region Review Board and replace that with a Dispute Review Board, which consists of a local representative, an external traffic engineer, a representative of the business community, and a member of ODOT. Those four people then would hear a dispute, and they would confer, evaluate the data, and then they'd make a recommendation to the region manager to approve or deny. Those would be where an access is denied or maybe where an access is approved with excessive mitigation. So it has a lot of opportunity to be beneficial. Other things that the statute would do would allow the use of a term move in the direction of where a developer wants to infill or redevelop within the urban area. If there was a rule before that allowed move in the direction of, but it's pretty limited on how it could be applied. This statute broadens that significantly and allows for more creative solutions. There will also be less costly mitigation measures when development does occur. There would be much more difficult to put a non-traversable median in the highway as part of an approach that you would request. That would then have benefits to neighboring properties that will not be as impacted. So the committee acknowledges that adoption of 264 will mean a lot of work for ODOT in revised administrative rules, the highway plan, manuals, training for staff. The committee has made a commitment to be involved in the process, review the rules and plans as those are developed. Simultaneous to this, they have identified several additional topics for future consideration, and these specifically get to what Senator Johnson brought up. The installation of raised means through a corridor, it's not related to an application but rather to a safety project. The project development process and how ODOT decisions associated with the project impacts adjacent property owners, access spacing standards, and development of plans within urban interchange areas. So all those three get to some of the issues Senator Johnson was talking to. This bill represents a major consensus between the industry, developers, cities, counties, Traffic Engineers Trucking, and ODOT. It achieves or seeks to achieve a balance of safety and mobility for all roadway users with economic development, and I think a key is to providing incentives for redevelopment and infill to occur within the urban area. It provides the agency with an opportunity to heighten customer service that occurs when an applicant requests an approach to the state highway. This bill, along with solutions for additional work, are intended to ensure that Oregon remains committed to providing safe highways, simultaneous support in economic development and prosperity while retaining livable communities across the state. Thank you.
Chair Barr, members of the committee, my name is Mark Whitlow. I served on the Access Management Committee on behalf of a couple of trade associations, the International Council of Shopping Centers, the Retail Task Force, Fred Meyer and Safeway, among others, are members of those groups. This has been a good process. It doesn't do everything. It started in 2010 with Senate Bill 1024. That was the first step to take change of use permits and make them clear and objective and allow more growth and development to occur. So that was the first movement toward codifying the access management administrative rules and placing them into statute using objective standards wherever possible. So this bite of the apple has been to take the rest of the permitting out of the rule, to place it into statute along with related procedures, and again to reduce them to objective standards or clear directives wherever possible, and it's done a good job of that. Those objective standards don't work for all applications, but for those that can address them in terms of spacing, channelization, site distance, then those applications can be reviewed and processed very quickly, subject to, as always, safety and highway operational considerations. So I've given you a letter that sort of bullet items the benefits as I see them. The takeaway, though, is that this work isn't done. We still have more to do. The Woodburn example would be the beneficiary of the next piece of work. We need to have some of these same concepts that have been addressed in this bill moved into the project development arena. And also take a look at the interchange area management plan provisions of the existing rule, because we don't think they work very well in urban areas. They were designed mostly for rural areas. So there's a lot of work that's still important that would continue to improve the balance between economic development and transportation management or access management. So we're pleased to continue to assist, and we're here to answer your questions if you have some.
Are there any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see. Mr. Russell, Mr. Campbell, Mr. Honeyman, and Mr. Jeffley.
Mr. Russell and Campbell are at another meeting. Wanted me to let you know that they won't be here.
Oh, how about that? How about Greg Honeyman? And Art, you want to come on up too? Art Schlott?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director of the League of Oregon Cities. We represent all 242 cities in the state of Oregon. With me is Jamie Jeffries, traffic engineer with the City of Portland, who will have her own statement to make, and due to her greater facility with some of the technical aspects of access management than I possess, hopefully would be able to answer any questions you might have of a technical nature. I will do the best I can to summarize, in the interest of time, the statement which is being distributed to you. I appear today on behalf of the League in support of Senate Bill 264 relating to access management standards. As previously stated, this emanates from legislation in the February supplemental session, Senate Bill 1024, requiring for more objective standards for access management. We were pleased to have been included in the aforementioned task force which developed the standards contained in this bill. By the way, I am referring to Dash 1 amendments through my testimony. We did at the outset have some misgivings about the need to, and stated this in testimony on Senate Bill 1024, in making statutory a rather complex set of rules, but are generally pleased that this bill, the Dash 1 amendments, fulfill the mandate while maintaining flexibility to deal with individual circumstances as they arrive. The real benefit of 264 is increased certainty for all stakeholders, state, local governments, business interests. Approach permits would now be granted more routinely and under prescribed timelines to meet certain specific criteria. Having said that, there is flexibility or the acknowledgement that one size does not fit all. The bill allows for a collaborative process at ODOT, where ODOT can improve, approve an approach when an applicant proposes to move, for example, in the direction of conforming with standards. Indeed, throughout the bill, there seems to be, in our view, a good balance struck between the need for specific standards and objective standards, while at the same time allowing applicants to seek deviations through a fact-based collaborative process with ODOT. As was just outlined for you, the disputes cannot be resolved. There's a collaborative process envisioned in the bill, or an appeals process, I should say. An access management dispute review board is established, again, with specific timelines. This board would look would include specific stakeholder interests, including a representative of local jurisdictions, a local government, perhaps a city, in which the dispute is located. Except for instances where variables will not permit it, Senate Bill 264 by narrative and in the tables in the bill specifically outline the objective conditions which you have already heard about. Having said this, I would be remiss if I did not tell you that it is worthy to note that there is a risk, I think, as Director Garrett indicated, of increased congestion and higher safety risks due to more driveways that would likely be permitted on state highways within urban areas. This is where cities sort of face a conundrum, if you will, between the desire for mobility but also and safety, but also economic development. Hopefully, the stakeholders going forward will figure out ways to make to ensure that these are not mutually exclusive concepts. Jurisdictional transfer, the actual transference of an ownership of a road from one entity to another, and this perhaps from ODOT to a city, is asserted as an access management tool in the bill. Together, ODOT and a local government may make a determination that it is in the best interest of all stakeholders that such a transference occur, and then triggering the normal jurisdictional transfer process. What is interesting in this bill is that for the first time, in addition to whatever traditional funding is provided for such a transference, there is the opportunity to have this discussion about an ongoing agreement between ODOT and the local entity for funding the construction, repair, maintenance, et cetera, of a road that's been transferred.
Finally.
There is an access management oversight task force created. Our only concern with that provision is that it stipulates among the 10 members to be named that there only be one local government representative. I'm not going to speak for the counties, but I believe both the cities and counties would like to be represented on such a board, and we would ask that the language in that section be changed to add one additional member to include a city. At least a city member, along with another presumably county local government member. With that, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Sorry to rush you, but
that's okay. I understand. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 264. My name is Jamie Jeffrey. I'm a traffic engineer with the City of Portland, and I also served as Portland's representative on the Access Management Committee. We have appreciated ODOT's partnership and expertise in trying to solve these problems, particularly would like to thank Director Garrett's positive guidance and direction in working with the task force. We view the changes in 264 to have a number of positive improvements in the area of access management in the rules, both the rules and the process. The primary areas that we see improving are that there will be a greater transparency of what applicants should expect when they come in through the application process, what the requirements would be. There's more flexibility, especially in the area of urban environments, where the context of what that environment is becomes very important and is very different from what rural environments end up dealing with. So that piece is very important, and then we see that the process will be greatly improved by the transparency and flexibility that these changes afford. Essentially, we will be able to take a highway that runs through a city like Portland, and we'll be able to evaluate it not just as a state highway, but hopefully as part of the local street network and what that urban area, the local needs are for that urban area. We tend to balance a number of things in cities that the state highway is not generally tasked with. We have livability issues and economic development and things like that as well. So I believe these changes will help. We support the jurisdictional transfer language. I think that the language that allows annual transfer of funds for things like repair and maintenance will definitely improve the success of jurisdictional transfers that we've attempted in the past. So we support the language there. And we recognize that there's still much more work to be done, and we look forward to opportunities to continue participating with ODOT in this.
Thank you. Art?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties. Here to, add our support for Senate Bill 264 with the Dash 1 amendments. And I'm going to be really brief as I can. 264 started out really as to correct an unintended consequence with Senate Bill 1024 at this point, and the fact that it removed counties' ability for access management on county roads. And to that end, Section 8 of the Dash 1s reinstates counties' authority for access management on county roads to the place it was prior to the Senate Bill 1024, and we are appreciative of the work to reinstate the language and the authority for counties for access management on county roads. Secondly, Section 24 of the Dash 1s speaks to jurisdictional transfers as it relates to the state and counties. Again, we've looked at that section, and we support the provisions of Section 24. And then finally, Mr. Chair, Section 27 speaks to the Access Management Oversight Task Force, and I would just echo the comment that was made by my colleague from the League of Oregon Cities, that the task force should include a representative of both local governments, cities, and counties. And with that, Mr. Chair,
thank you.
I'm pleased my testimony. Any questions? I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. That's all I have on the list. Is there anybody else that feels really like they want to talk today? Richard, for the record.
For the record, we did get a letter in support of the measure from Don Forrest, who works for Fred Meyer.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 26 Senate Bill 264, and I will say that is there anybody who feels like they can't be here on Thursday for Senate Bill 795 or 672? Seeing none, we will carry those over until both of those bills until Thursday, right?
Okay.
All righty, is there anything else? We are adjourned.
Okay.